The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Last week, we spoke in very general terms about Armenia, Armenian history, institutions, and ideas. And I generally didn't confine it to any particular era. I tried to be as general as possible, using some of the more respected sources in the academic literature right now. That background being taken care of, tonight we're going to deal with the Armenian Genocide, taking place largely in 1915. And if we have time, we'll deal with some issues concerning Armenia after its independence from the Soviet Union. We may or may not be able to get to that. If we can't get to that, I'll end up doing that some other time. Anyway, the context of the genocide. Turkey joined the Central Powers. They had very close relations with Germany. The Germans kind of took over from the English in supporting the military infrastructure of the decaying Ottoman state. And so, given the competition among Austria, Germany, Russia, and Turkey for the Balkans, plus the German involvement in the Ottoman state, the Ottoman Empire declared for the Central Powers. And that was done as most Armenians sympathized with Russia and therefore sympathized with the Allies, for better or for worse. One big problem is that Armenians were split they were spread all over the world, but Armenians were split between Turkish Armenians and Russian Armenians. And then the second problem was that there were Armenian units within the Ottoman army as well as the Russian army. That automatically meant that the Turks accused regularly the Armenians, starting roughly in 1915, of collusion with the Allies, especially concerning the landing of the British at Gallipoli, and the general support of the Allied cause. And one of the first acts, I mean, there had been Turkish massacres and Islamic massacres against the Armenians going back many, many centuries. I've always thought that it was the Armenians and the Irish who have the longest history of suffering, in the sense that there have been dozens upon dozens upon dozens of state-sponsored attempts to destroy and to annihilate those two particular populations. Irish Catholics, I should say, specifically, not Protestants. But as far as the genocide, the 1915 genocide, one of the first major acts was the removal of Ottoman Armenian soldiers from the Ottoman army and their use as forced labor. And essentially, they became the slaves of the Ottoman state, and many of them died through maltreatment and overwork. Then the Turks decided that they were going to remove Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire that were living on the Russian-Turkish border, and to move them away from that border. And in the process, they were forced to march to Syria. And on that forced march, according to eyewitnesses, most died. They were not fed. They were not cared for. and then they were brought to what essentially were open-air concentration camps without any amenities whatsoever in the Syrian desert. And as several people who interviewed many witnesses, especially the German Foreign Office and Turkey, which backs up the entire narrative of the genocide, was very worried about the political implications of the genocide. There are reports that the Armenians were sold as slaves to both Jewish and Islamic slave traders still operating in the Syrian desert. Henry Morgenthau, who at the time was the U.S. ambassador to Istanbul or Constantinople, actually personally witnessed some of these atrocities from the Ottoman authorities to the Armenians. And there is also some first-hand accounts of medical experimentation on Armenian prisoners, both military and civilian. The U.S. consulate in Syria went on record as seeing the tortures, medical experiments, beatings, and murders, and reported back to the United States, to the federal government in Washington, that thousands were killed, at least in Syria, those who were forced to march from the Ottoman border to Syria, where they were interred in the desert. The German consulate in the Ottoman Empire reports that roughly 150 to 200 Armenians died in these camps throughout the Ottoman Empire every day. And that they describe some of these camps in detail. The Germans, who were allies of the Ottoman Empire, had described these camps as essentially open air, simply an open desert area surrounded by barbed wire, with very, very little in terms of food and water. There is an Ottoman official, Naim Bey, who was an employee of the deportation office. There was a special bureaucracy, an Ottoman bureaucracy, dedicated to these deportations and the creation of the concentration camps. His personal documents and journal have been translated. And the basic view of the deportation office was that the war was an excuse for a decaying, suffering Ottoman Empire to get rid of and to exterminate its Armenian minority. And the German Foreign Office in Istanbul also agreed with this point of view. So the evidence and the first-hand accounts of the Turkish genocide are absolutely incontestable, especially when they come from, number one, the deportation office itself, and number two, the German consulate and German witnesses both in Istanbul itself as well as Syria. And it should be noted that the Armenian population of Istanbul or Constantinople had been eliminated, and actually had been eliminated more than once in Turkish history. The excuse was that Armenians were opposed to the Turkish war effort, but the reality was that the creation of a new Ottoman state, in whatever political form it was going to take, required a Turkish and Islamic, although those could be separated, identity, and of course that did not include Armenians in any way. So what we're talking about, I mean, the historical background here is the slow but sure weakening of the Ottoman state. They had suffered substantial internal civil war, especially with Muhammad Ali of Egypt, Serbian, Greek, Bulgarian victories, Russian pressure from the northeast. And whether it was the Sultan or the Young Turks, and the Sultan was a far more moral individual than the Young Turks as a unit were, but whoever you asked, generally speaking, the idea was to reconsolidate the empire in some kind of religio-ethnic basis. It should be noted that in the writings of scholars like Stepan Asturian, writing in 1990, that the Kurds were mobilized against the Armenians, and they were empowered legally to enslave Armenians as chattel slaves. And so there's numerous accounts of Kurdish slavery, of Kurds enslaving Armenians, and that gives credence to the other reports coming from the German as well as the American Foreign Office that in the forced deportations to Syria, Ottoman soldiers and merchants of both Islamic and Jewish background and now Kurdish background made money in trading Armenians in slaves. And the fact that Armenians generally look to Russia for protection suggested that Armenians will always be a distrusted minority in the Ottoman Empire, especially after the Ottomans suffered so many defeats over and over again at the hands of Russia and the Russian Empire on the one hand, as well as their allies Bulgaria and Serbia in the Balkans on the other hand. It was fairly clear by 1875 onward, prior to the Young Turk Revolution, of course, that pan-Islamism was going to be the new legitimating ideology of the Ottoman Empire. And as a result of that, of course, Armenians could have no part. And it should be noted from the 1880s onward, of course, there were many precursors to this genocide, one of which was the constant looting of Armenian homes and businesses. The Armenians were successful economically. They were sort of a mid-range bourgeoisie, very much involved in the merchant class and small business. And these businesses were stormed, destroyed, and then liquidated, the money going to the Ottoman government as well as Ottoman military and police units. And the Armenians, needless to say, along with the Greeks, that were another a fairly successful minority in the Turkish Empire, the Armenians and Greeks supported this basic inter-ethnic cooperation within the Ottoman Empire in order to create some kind of united front against any radical pan-Islamism that, of course, would eliminate them all from any kind of political authority. The Armenians had done well in the Ottoman Empire. They had, some of them anyway, had risen to fairly high positions, largely as linguists and also as technicians and economists. But throughout the 19th century, the Armenian minority, which was always very literate and politically very aware, began to move to a sort of a modern 19th century nationalism, which frightened the Ottoman state, which was already insecure. So the basic concept, the turn of the century, there was a movement of a secular Turkic nationalism that set its face against the Ottoman Empire as such, as a sultanate, and viewed the Ottoman Empire as effeminate and exceptionally religious, when, of course, in their view, the wave of the future was secular, militant, and a military-based nationalism. By 1907, elite units of the Turkish army, especially the, I believe it's the 3rd Army Corps, which was based in Salonika, was an immensely significant city. They began to cooperate with the Young Turk movement to overthrow the Sultan. And even some Armenians wanted the Sultan out of power because of their long history of anti-Armenian massacres and dispossession, without fully realizing at the time the aims of the Young Turks relative to the Armenian cause. Turkish politics between 1908 and 1913, as reported not only in by first-hand accounts, but also by Asturian himself, writing in the history teacher in 1990, that the politics was generally between two factions. Those who wanted to tightly centralize the empire and those who wanted to experiment with communalization or decentralization, self-government of the specific parts of the empire. Needless to say, both the army and the Young Turks supported centralization. Many supporters of the Sultan supported decentralization, although you can find Armenians on both sides of that debate. 1909, an Islamic movement engaged what was essentially a coup d'etat, and in 1909 the Islamic movement began some substantial massacres of the Armenians in the cities of the empire. And by 1913, the decentralist movement had largely been eliminated. Some people in the literature on this subject, they call the decentralizers liberals. And that's, you know, that's a very sloppy use of an already sloppy sloppy word. But there was a strong Islamic movement connected with the more or less secular pan-Turkish sort of a, you know, a proto-Young Turk struggle to create a new, modern, centralized Turkish state. And one of the theorists of this coalition was a Jewish writer by the name of Moyes Cohen, who died in 1961, of course, took a Turkic-sounding name as a pseudonym. And the Young Turk movement, which was connected with Turkish trade at Salonika, probably the most important port city in the Balkans, and also was not only the Jewish capital of the Balkans, but also the Masonic capital of the Balkans, because the Rothschild clan was heavily involved in financing the trading firms in Salonika, as well as the oil fields in Baku, which will later become the capital of Azerbaijan in southern Russia. So you had probably the wealthiest city in the Balkans, which was the seat of a major faction of the Ottoman army, also the seat of the intellectual movement that came to be known as the Young Turks. It was deeply involved both in Jewish and Masonic politics, connected to the Rothschild family at the turn of the century. So there was this oil combine controlled largely by the Rothschilds that connected Salonika to Baku and the oil fields within the Russian Empire. So as far as the Young Turks were concerned, the Armenians were not Islamic, they were not Turkish, and therefore they could not have anything to do with the new movement that was being created with this centralist coalition, kind of a loose centralist coalition of some Islamists, the army, and the Young Turks. And for people like Cohen and others, the Armenians and Greeks were economic parasites that needed to be destroyed. 1915-1916 was the organized movement to destroy the Armenian educational and economic infrastructure in the empire. And by the way, the first few years of World War One, this complete destruction of Armenian economic structures within the empire destroyed the empire. It's one of the things that removed a substantial amount of income to Istanbul, and the destruction of the economy was at least partially created by this looting of the Armenian economic infrastructure in the society. And it was very clear that the Turkish nationalists, of which the Young Turks were a faction, did support the Central Powers. So the old accusation that the Armenians were disloyal continued. And when the Turks were defeated fairly regularly against the Russians during World War I, the automatic refrain was it was not the problem of the army, it was the problem of our Armenian minority, and they need to be destroyed. There isn't much of a doubt that the secular Young Turk movement had elements of both Freemasonry and Jewish power within it. And how ironic it is, and how bizarre it is, that the Young Turk newspaper, which was actually called the Young Turk, was edited by Jakobinski, became the hero of the Jewish nationalist movement. And I want to make it clear that many writers have held that it was the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry connected with London and hence the Rothschild banks that dominated the social and civic life of Salonika. Salonika is a key area in the history of the Balkans, and it was the seat of this occult movement to take over the Ottoman Empire, to support the Central Powers, to recreate and centralize the Ottoman Empire completely as a new society. But in the process of doing this, the Armenians needed to be destroyed. In mid-February, really throughout 1915, the Armenian population of the Ottoman Empire was wiped out, probably at a number of roughly 2 million. Although, to be fair, I want to say that there were many Turks, including Turkish nationalists, were opposed to the slaughter and the slavery of the Armenians, at least on economic grounds. They were simply too valuable economically to be eliminated. Although Cohen was one of the leading forces, in favor of the destruction of the Armenians. But that's really the historical background and the methods of the Armenian genocide of 1915. And the Jewish official denial of the Armenian Holocaust just goes to show the hateful contempt and double standards of the Jewish elite from the Salonika Jewish merchants to the slavers of Syria to the Anti-Defamation League in the United States. And it just shows you what a fraud a lot of the prattling of the ADL really is. It's not human rights. It's not saving people's lives. It's not the destruction of bigotry and racism. It is the support of Jewish supremacy under any and all circumstances. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalists. This is part two of two broadcasts on Armenia and Armenian nationalism. And in this broadcast, I gave a thumbnail sketch of the mentality, the politics behind the Armenian genocide, which eliminated between 1.5 and 2 million Armenians, either through starvation, through outright murder, torture, medical experimentation, and of course the concentration camp system, mainly in Ottoman Syria, but also throughout the empire. And then we're going to conclude this broadcast, the next 20 minutes or so, dealing with modern Armenia after the fall of the Soviet Union. And an excellent piece, I think a very balanced piece by Peter Rutland. It was written in Europe-Asia Studies in 1994 concerning Armenian nationalism is an excellent summary of some of the big issues, especially concerning the ongoing struggle in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a part of Azerbaijan, but is about 75% Armenian. And Rutland holds to the view that the ethnic battle between Armenia and Azerbaijan was one of the things that brought down Mikhail Gorbachev and the Soviet Union, because it forced him to confront the national question and fail at confronting the national question. And the fact is that because he would not give this Armenian province of Azerbaijan to Armenia where it belongs, it disillusioned a lot of reformists within the Communist Party and within the Soviet Union itself. And even more than that, the Armenian articulation of the ethnic problem encouraged nationalist movements elsewhere, especially in Ukraine and the Baltic states. You know, I mean, we last week we dealt with the whole question of the lack of any Armenian state from the fall of Cilician Armenia, really, to 1918. Armenia functioned as a diaspora people. Armenia under the Soviet Union was a success. The Armenians, like the Georgians, had a tendency to exceed their quotas, especially in the high-tech items that they specialized in. And as a result, Armenia was largely left alone. Armenia was largely run by Armenians within the Soviet Union. Armenia, by 1990, was 94% Armenian. It was a highly compact nationalist state within the Soviet Union and was one of the more successful economic parts of the Soviet Union. It was essentially left alone. And their economic success, as well as their education and ability, they were disproportionately found in Russian universities, in the high-tech sector, in the scientific sector. But as the Soviet Union began to weaken, problems developed. Azerbaijan cleared its capital city of Baku of its Armenian population. This was one of the most violent forms of ethnic cleansing that not only was not condemned by the West, but supported by the West. In 1990, the population of Baku, the Armenian population, went from 200,000 to 15,000. And battles began to develop from then on between Azerbaijan, Islamic and Turkic in background, against the Christian Indo-European Armenians. And the MVD, or the Soviet Interior Ministry, in Nagorno-Karabakh were Armenians. A substantial percentage of the security forces in that area were Armenians, and as a result of this, the Azeris began to create militias and to arm themselves. In Armenia, substantial strikes, including a huge general strike that paralyzed the country in October-November of 1990, forced Soviet troops to impose a curfew and to occupy Armenia, which was very rare. Armenia essentially was used to being more or less independent within the Soviet Union. And Azerbaijan not only was racially and religiously distinct from Armenia, but it was ruled even by 1991 by an old Brezhnevite Stalinist clique. And so they, of course, politically had nothing to do with Armenia. The West, as I even mentioned, with the old Rothschild investment in the Baku oil fields, and in the 1990s, the knowledge by the Western oil firms of the strategic significance of Baku and its oil, as well as its transit capability, the West rejected all the claims of the Armenians. And it's no accident that today Azerbaijan is very closely related and allied with Israel and the major oil firms in the United States to keep both Russia and Armenia at bay, and the Azerbaijani government as of today is very closely allied with the West in the hope of receiving Western investment in its oil industry. But at the same time, Boris Yeltsin, as well as Gorbachev before him, had rejected these Armenian claims. And as the Soviet Union began to unravel, the Soviet political movement rigged every election, according to Rutland's analysis. And the West, to a great extent, encouraged the vote fraud that made sure that Armenian nationalists were kept out of power throughout the elections of 1991, and also in Nagorno-Karabakh itself, where, of course, the sentiment was overwhelmingly in favor of secession and joining Armenia. The vote was rigged to make it appear that there was no interest in that. The problem from Armenia at the time, of course, is that about 80% of Armenian energy came through Azerbaijan, and it was from the oil pipeline from Baku to Yerevan and throughout Armenia, and so the West was not about to anger an oil-rich part of the Soviet Union. So the West backed Azerbaijan and rejected Armenians. Not to mention the simple fact that Turkey and Israel, allies, and of course Turkey was a part of NATO, wanted no support whatsoever given to the Armenian cause. So the West had every reason in their own minds to disenfranchise the Armenian nationalist movement as much as possible. Not too long afterwards, the West encouraged yet another Azeri pogrom in Baku. About 160 were killed of the remaining 50,000, and many of those remaining 50,000 were forced to flee the country and go to Armenia. The Russian troops then had to clash with the Azerbaijani or Azeri militia, and 29 Soviet soldiers were killed in the warfare against Azerbaijan. But I need to make it clear that it was the Western oil firms and corporate interests who controlled the state in the Western world backed the oil-rich Azerbaijani Stalinist government against the nationalist movement in Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh. And this is when both Turkey and Israel began to deny the Armenian Holocaust of 1915. This is when it became okay and even fashionable to deny the Armenian Holocaust. So that kind of Holocaust denial apparently is not a problem from Brussels to Tel Aviv to New York City. No one, of course, believed that any of the voting that took place in post-Soviet Armenia in the first few years was honest. There was no sense of any honesty whatsoever. And of course, the West immediately put its stamp of approval on these fraudulent elections. And by 1992, the Armenian industrial production, you know, Armenia was one of the really the central provinces of the Soviet Union, as small as it was. Because of the technical expertise of the Armenian population, it was a very important high-tech sector in the Soviet Union. But its industrial base, given the war, given Azerbaijan's embargo, oil embargo, which was encouraged both by the West and the Soviet Union, what was left of it, on Armenia, its economy completely collapsed. By 1992, its industrial production had fallen by 50%. And all of this occurs after fairly successful Armenian life in the USSR. Now, I don't want to say that Armenians were left alone by Stalin. They most certainly were not. And in fact, because of the high incidence of Armenians in the professions and in the universities, Armenians suffered, like Ukrainians, disproportionately from the purges of the 1930s. But under Khrushchev, his interest in limited decentralization of industry and the attempt to create a consumer goods sector did help the Armenian economy substantially. And in the late 50s and throughout the 1960s, I think there's plenty of evidence that the Armenian economy was very successful, and it was equally as successful as Georgia. And Georgia and Armenia have a lot in common because they're both firmly nationalists. Their states are very advanced, and they both had a tendency to exceed their quotas during the period of the central planning. But under the Khrushchev system, and the so-called collective leadership, both Armenia and Georgia prospered. And all they really needed to do was to be left alone. And if you left them alone, they served not only as a high-tech center, both Armenia and Georgia, high-tech centers of the Soviet Union, but they also were facilitators of trade from north to south. And Armenia as a strategic facilitator, something that's given to it by its very geographical position and its lack of arable land. So the Armenian merchant mentality and its strong stress on reason and literacy made Armenia fairly successful until, of course, the stagnation of the 1970s and Brezhnev's re-centralization harmed the Armenian economy. And the fact is that after all of the violence in the early 90s, after the blockade was lifted and Azeri oil was permitted to flow back to Armenia, the first decade of the 2000s showed double-digit economic growth. Again, as always, in the high-tech sector. It's only in the last few years, at least according to the CIA, that Armenia has fallen into yet another rut. And CIA statistics, which are always iffy in my view, but the Armenian economy has contracted by 15% at the end of 2009 and the beginning of 2010. I wrote an article a few years ago on Armenia as being one of the targets of the New World Order and of the Israeli state. That Azerbaijan has become a client both of Israel and Turkey, and there's very few Jews in Azerbaijan. There is a large Chabad center in Baku that serves essentially as a conduit for Israeli policy, and they have supported the anti-Armenian government there. And it was Azerbaijan that was used as a base for a lot of anti-Russian moves of both CIA and Mossad, and they were also involved in the revolution in Georgia. And the Islamic movements of Azerbaijan and Turkey are directed both by CIA and Mossad against this emerging nexus of Russia, Armenia, and Iran. I want to make it clear that as of now, 2011, the Armenian community in Iran is autonomous, is pro-Iranian, and is fairly well off, economically speaking. And it's certainly in the interest of the Iranians because this energy pipeline from Russia, Iran, via Armenia is one of the main axes against the New World Order. And as a result, Armenia, although much smaller than Iran or Russia, has a major role as a conduit, not only of oil and natural gas, but also of ideas, of technology, and of the building of this anti-New World Order movement. And the result of this is that Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Israel, with American assistance and assistance from both the Rockefeller Foundation, the major oil firms, and George Soros, are creating an alliance against Armenia. And the Israeli hatred of Armenia, I think, was really manifest. I think it was in 2007. The head of the Mossad in Georgia, Rivka Cohen, kind of, you know, lost his temper and began to scream that Israel would never recognize and would, in fact, deny the Armenian Holocaust of 1915 to 1921. And the denial of the Armenian Holocaust is the stock and trade of Mossad operations, both in Asia as well as America. The head of Shabbat in Azerbaijan is Rabbi Meir Brook, who I think has in the past made it very clear that Israel and world Jewry in general support the Azerbaijani state and the Islamic movement there, and that as soon as Rabbi Brook began preaching against Armenia a few years ago, suddenly out of nowhere, swastikas are painted on the synagogue in Yerevan, and these things happen out of nowhere, timed precisely with Rabbi Brook's condemnation of the Armenian cause as this conduit between Russia and Iran, and hence the Russian re-entry into Central Asia. So it's clear that the Israeli government, the major oil firms in the West, Western governments, the Rothschild clan, the big foundations are very interested in the Caucasus Mountains. I think George Soros is interested in it because Azerbaijanis, Kurds, Kurds, by the way, deeply infiltrated by Mossad, and Turks, as well as Mossad itself, are involved with heavy drug running as well as prostitution out of Afghanistan and among other places, and of course coming through the Caucasus Mountains, and then it could infect Russia and then the rest of Europe that way. Armenian intransigence in this regard and its refusal to deal with this and to support Russia and Russia's attempt to destroy this is yet one more reason why the system clearly has fought this Armenian alliance both with Russia and Iran. I know this is very complicated, but all of these issues are connected. And the fact is that the size of a country has nothing to do with its importance. And countries like Portugal and Israel are clearly proof of that. It's their strategic significance. It's their natural resources. It's their native abilities. And just as important, it's their geographic location. And the result of Azerbaijani oil and its very close connection with Mossad has brought Armenia to become one of the major players in the battle against the New World Order. And that is what's behind the attack and the now fashionable denial of the Armenian Holocaust of 1915. really, in essence, from 1915 to 1921. And so this has become stock and trade of Mossad, and Mossad has set up shop in Baku in Azerbaijan with essentially about the 200 Jews that live in that country, many of whom are wealthy and involved in industry and media, and it's become a major Mossad center of operations against Armenia, again, with the westernized Georgian government, the Soros movement. And it's really a springboard both against Russia and Iran. And, of course, Armenia is stuck in the middle. So these last two broadcasts, to sum up here, are really meant to give a very brief thumbnail sketch of what the Armenian mentality is and where it comes from and why they're significant and why nationalists and Christians, wherever they might be, should support the Armenian cause in any way that they can. Because it's my opinion that Armenia is one of the conduits of the nationalist movement and regionalist movement against the New World Order. And it's her position as a transit point of Russian oil and gas, as well as high-tech processing equipment, make it very, very important to the Iranians. And the Iranians never supported the movement in Azerbaijan, and certainly not its connection with Mossad. And so, the New World Order in general. And the New World Order doesn't really have any ideology except oligarchy. It doesn't make any difference whether their supporters are Catholic or Jewish or Islamic. It makes no difference because oligarchy is an end in and of itself. And Mossad, CIA, MI6, New World Order has supported Islamic movements in Nagorno-Karabakh, in Bosnia, in Azerbaijan, in Kosovo. And so to think that the New World Order, the system as a whole, is anti-Islamic is absolute nonsense. The only thing that it hates is any kind of real idealist social movement for real civic virtue and ethnic nationalism. And of course, as always, true ancient Christianity as the ultimate evil. So I thank you for listening. I appreciate your attention. I'll talk to you next time. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.